taking over a century of children's stories and assembling a comprehensive collection is quite an undertaking. Now, make those stories that were originally written in Yiddish, and you end up with an impressive package of all forms of writing and unique perspectives of the world. And that's why we're talking today with Miriam Udell. Dr. Udell is a rabbi and an associate professor in the Department of German Studies and the Tam Institute of Jewish Studies at Emory University. Her new collection is called Honey on the Page, a treasury of Yiddish children's literature. I asked why she took on this project now.
Well, I did not take on this project now. It's coming to fruition now, but I started working on it in 2013 when I had two young children and was also teaching the Yiddish language quite regularly at the beginner level. And I reflected on my own experiences studying languages like Spanish, Hebrew, Arabic, and I realized that I had always been exposed to some kind of children's literature in those languages, but never when I myself was learning Yiddish. And I wondered whether there were any texts that I might want to share with my own children or with my students that they would be able to negotiate after a semester of Yiddish. And that led me to a search for Yiddish children's literature. And almost as soon as I began the search, I realized that there was an embarrassment of riches. Not only had almost 1,000 books been preserved, but they had even been digitized and they were just sitting on a website waiting for somebody to come along and do something with them. And I thought, why shouldn't I be that somebody?
I'd like you to tell us the story of the title of the book, Honey on the Page.
So the title gestures at a custom that goes back to the Jewish communities of Eastern Europe and maybe even further than that. And the custom was that on the first day of school, the teacher would take each pupil's alphabet primer and dab it with a bit of honey. And before beginning the formal lessons, each child would lick up that honey so that all of the ensuing learning would be sweet. And I wanted to infuse learning for today's children and families about Jewish culture and Yiddish literature with a similar feeling of sweetness and excitement.
Every day where I work, one of the managers comes by and throws some chocolate on our desk and says, good morning, how is everything? And I see you have a similar story.
That's right. So I described the custom of the olden days in Europe, and I grew up with a similar custom, although it was adapted for the modern American classroom, which may or may not be equipped with a sink. And what happened in my case was that when I started Hebrew school, the teacher came around and just cascaded a few little chocolates, something coated like M&Ms, so that it was neat and not too melty. But she put them onto each of our workbooks that first day of class and told us to eat the chocolate and that our process of learning Hebrew should be as sweet as those chocolates. So in the same way that what she did took something ancient and modernized it, I'm hoping that through the act of translation, I can make that wild honey sweetness available in a manageable form for English language modern readers.
Have you seen an uptick in interest in Jewish heritage and literature lately?
I have. I've seen an uptick in general Jewish interest and also specifically in Yiddish culture. I think that generations between the end and the aftermath of the Holocaust and my own young adulthood kept on planting seeds in the form of educational programs, programs for language study for Yiddish, investments in translation and teaching people how to translate. And all of those seeds that were planted during the 1960s and 70s and 80s are now really bearing fruit. And I've even been at this long enough. I graduated from with my PhD in 2008. I started graduate school in 2001, and I've now been teaching for long enough that I can see my own students going on to do exciting, transformative things on the Yiddish cultural scene.
Let's talk a little about some of the authors of the stories that you translated. I understand many of them were teachers, right?
That's right. There is a range of what these authors did and who they were. And some of them are the brightest lights in Yiddish letters of the 20th century, people who were what we might call Yiddish famous, even if they're not household names in contemporary America. And others were really very close to children, working throughout their careers as teachers, school administrators, and in those kinds of roles where they were really very close to the everyday experiences of the children in their care.
And many of these stories, I'd say most of these stories are from, almost 100 years ago.
That's right. They start to be written in the 19-teens and really begin flowering in the 20s and 30s. And then, of course, some of the stories come to us in the aftermath of the Holocaust. And they are, on the one hand, so much older than most of what we're handing to our children to read today. And on the other hand, I think so many of them feel fresh and contemporary and teach lessons and also involve experiences that, for better or for worse, are quite familiar to us today. And when I say for better or for worse, I mean something like The Mute Princess by Tzina Rabinovich, which is a story about a girl who's been orphaned by a pandemic.
Oh, no, you can take that one right out. As you were translating this, how did you bring stories written in Yiddish that long ago into contemporary language for children?
So I had to really think about that and revisit it often, because what happened with Yiddish children's literature is that, as I said, it starts to be written in the teens, and then it's just like somebody turned on the spigot to the fire hose, and there was so much being produced so quickly. And it took this body of work a little bit of time to catch up with the idea of actually writing to address children. And what I mean by that is that in a lot of the work from the teens and the early 20s, the vocabulary is so sophisticated. The stories are written in such a lofty register, as if they were writing for tiny little adults. And then by the 1930s, we really see a distinctive idiom emerging for talking to kids, you know, like we have horses and bunnies and duckies in contemporary English when we're talking to young children. So I always had to ask myself as a translator, how much do I want to preserve a sense of otherness and distance and strangeness in a text? And how much do I want to naturalize the text and to make it familiar to our own sort of linguistic surroundings? And I think that the best answer to that varied for me from day to day and from text to text.
As you discovered these authors, are there any of them whose stories just really stood out to you as authors and people?
Yes, probably too many to name, because what I came to discover was that I was producing a book of nearly 50 stories and poems aimed at children, but I was also producing a kind of parallel collage history of the Jewish 20th century, at least the 20th century for the Jews of Eastern Europe and those who had migrated from Eastern Europe. And the life histories of the authors themselves were so fascinating. And I was able to include a capsule biography of each one of the writers. And most of the time, that was pretty straightforward because I relied on existing reference works. But in a few cases, particularly for the female authors, I did not find enough satisfactory biographical data to even put that together from existing sources. And I had to get really creative. But just to name one of those authors who had a fascinating life and also wrote incredible fiction, somebody that I hope will become something of a household name, Tzina Rabinovich, who published a lot in the 1950s, and she published in Latin America, where a lot of the publishing activity had shifted after the war. And she wrote a collection of wonderful holiday tales that are set in places that we might not associate right away with Yiddish literature, places like Casablanca, Morocco, and the island of Trinidad. And she also wrote a magnificent generational saga, a novella that covers four generations of a Jewish family stretching from the 1850s in Frankfurt, Germany, all the way to the land of Israel after World War II on a modern kibbutz. And she tells the story of this family and everything that they have to survive through their relationship with a beautifully carved stick of olive wood. That's carved with a biblical verse. And this stick of olive wood accompanies four generations of this single family on all kinds of adventures and wartime misadventures.
I was trying to think of an intelligent way to ask this question, and I'm going to fail miserably, but here I go. Are there any stories in here, and you might have just described one, that are distinctly Jewish, that really have the young Jewish experience from the time it was written?
Well, that question is actually right on, because the whole organizational principle for the book is one that I found in the old anthologies from the 20s and 30s. And that is that the book moves from the most distinctly Jewish material, what I call the three H's of Jewish holidays, history, and heroes. And it broadens outward from there to the kinds of genres that we expect to find in all different sorts of children's literature, folk tales, fairy tales, stories about fools and foolishness versus wisdom, allegories, parables. And then I end up with a set of topics that are nearly universal for children everywhere. Going to school, which is now a little bit less universal during the pandemic, when so many of us are homeschooling our children. But hopefully that will return to being an almost universal experience for children. The learning that we do outside of school in life's classroom. And finally, I think the most universal human experience of all, which is belonging to a family.
Well, one of the most universal experiences I saw was in probably one of the shortest things in the book, which was a poem with the title, Just Three Question Marks.
That's right. This is a wonderful poem that I think evokes so much more than it says. And it's so short that I'm going to just go ahead and read it. So yes, the title of this poem by Ida Maze is Question Mark, Question Mark, Question Mark. If you were me and I were you, I'd be in your shoes. I would be eight and four's what you'd be. So then would you play with me? And that's the whole poem. And it's really the appeal of a younger child to that fascinating, enticing, slightly older child who has no interest in the younger kid. And the younger child is asking, hey, if the tables were turned, then would I be interesting to you? Would you be willing to play with me? And I think it's just such a delightful micro portrait of empathy and the need for empathy and imagining ourselves into the shoes of the other person who's in a situation that we may one day inhabit or that we might have inhabited long ago.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Mary Mudell continues with a look at some contemporary stories that are in the collection. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. And our guest today is Dr. Miriam Udell, a rabbi and an associate professor in the Department of German Studies and the Tam Institute of Jewish Studies at Emory University. We're talking about her new book for young people called Honey on the Page, A Treasury of Yiddish Children's Literature. While many of the stories in the book are old, some more than a century old, there are some that are a bit more contemporary. I asked when some of the newer stories in the collection were written.
So this collection takes us into the 70s, and the final selection in the book is the first chapter of a wonderful group of stories that I hope to translate in its entirety one day, called An Unusual Girl from Brooklyn, and it's by David Roden. And the book introduces us to a little girl living in the Brooklyn of the 1930s, even though the book is in fact published in 1973. And this little girl has a superpower that's also something of an Achilles heel for her. She is a very intense reader. She always has a book in her hand, and her superpower is that whatever is happening in the world of the book, she perceives to be happening in her real life. And I put real in quotation marks because, of course, we're talking about a fictional girl in a fictional story. But she gets herself into all kinds of sticky situations. And in this first chapter, she ends up prompting a gaggle of neighborhood moms to call the fire department and to try to bring her down from the top of a lamppost where she has climbed up in order to try to read her book uninterrupted.
If you could have made this book larger, how much more material is there?
To be honest, Bob, I think that there would be an entire second volume. The book is not a small one. It weighs in at nearly 350 pages. And there is so much good material that I left on the cutting room floor. There are novellas, other long pieces, long short stories. There are also plays that I felt I could not really do justice to as a translator. The dialogue came out a little bit wooden in my attempts at rendering it. But I think that somebody with more of a background in theater might be able to take some of those plays and breathe new life into them. So there is a lot of material still to be discovered and worked with.
That would be interesting to watch them being staged. It really would.
I agree.
As you were doing this, what surprised you? What did you say? You know, I didn't expect that.
I think the diversity and variety of the settings of the stories really surprised me. I think that because I was reared, and for the most part, my children were reared on contemporary American children's literature, the range of concerns that enters into these stories and the frankness about historical violence and other hard topics, and also the frankness about politics and political engagement and what that looks like, even at the kid level, was somewhat surprising.
Yeah, this is certainly not the Cat in the Hat.
It is not the Cat in the Hat.
No.
In fact, by reading about when the birds go on strike, a child might even learn the mechanics of nonviolent protest.
In the end, what do you hope readers walk away with this book from, both younger readers and older readers?
I hope that they walk away with the lessons of the stories themselves, many of which have to do with really deeply held and widely shared human values like generosity and fellow feeling, and what it means to identify with and care about another person. And I also hope that they walk away with a kind of reading experience that has become unusual in modern times. And what I mean by that is that now, as soon as children can read independently, we tend to send them off with their books and we read our adult books. But what I hope this book invites us to do is to share reading experiences across generations, either through reading out loud and enjoying some of the narrative rhyming poetry and other work that just sounds beautiful to the ear, or through independent reading experiences that then become shared ones through discussion over the dinner table or in a classroom or a library setting. And I'm hoping that just as the pandemic got us baking and crafting and gardening as a family, that maybe it will also get us reading as a family, and that this book can be part of that rediscovery.
Again, the name of Miriam Udell's wonderful new collection and translation of stories for young people is Honey on the Page, a treasury of Yiddish children's literature. At the end of this month, you'll be hearing a lot of talk about President Biden's first 100 days in office. So, why do we care about the first 100 days of a presidency? To get an answer, I spoke to Adam Caton, an associate professor of government in the Reuben O.D. Askew Department of Government at the University of West Florida. That's the question. What's the deal with 100 days?
Sure. It's mostly just tradition. The Franklin Roosevelt administration that started in 1933 had what's become a legendary period of policy productivity during its first 100 days when he requested Congress pass a number of sweeping legislative enactments to address the Great Depression. And because his party had an overwhelming majority in Congress, he was able to get a friendly legislature to pass, you know, massive policy reforms in a really short amount of time. So his first 100 days is pointed to as one of the most productive periods in the history of any presidential administration. And what was remarkable about it is that in terms of turning the slow-moving ship of American public policy, 100 days is a very short time. So it's become common since then to take stock of what a president is doing after their first 100 days in office. But really, there's nothing special about 100 days other than it's a round number. And Franklin Roosevelt had a productive 100 days. Although, again, like we could easily be talking about his first 99 days yes. or his first 101 days. It doesn't really matter.
Is the 100-day test an accurate sign of a successful presidency?
I don't think so. It can be a good indicator. A lot of presidents get more done earlier in their administration than later. But some goals take a long time to achieve, and some policies aren't enacted until later. We wouldn't have known how history would see many of our presidents in the first 100 days of their administrations. So take, for example, presidents who left office and are viewed as being unresponsive to policy problems. I'm thinking of people like Jimmy Carter or Herbert Hoover, who have not gone down in history as our most effective presidents. And their first 100 days, they looked great because in Hoover's case, the Great Depression was still years down the road, or I guess months down the road in his case. So I don't think it's a great barometer. But it's a good way for the public to see what a president is trying to do, but it's far too early to determine whether or not they'll be successful.
So there you go. I got my answer. Adam Caton is an associate professor of government at the University of West Florida. With many students still taking a majority of their classes remotely, some families are looking for an extra educational boost. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
After-school education is taking hold during online learning at schools. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Pawan Dhingra, professor of American Studies at Amherst College, wonders if it helps or hinders children.
Now that remote learning has become the norm, parents increasingly worry that their children may not be learning as much as they can. This anxiety has fueled an already growing interest in for-profit after-school tutoring companies, such as Kumon, Mathnasium, and others, even for children performing well in school. This is despite many educators' sense that such learning can limit children and that it worsens educational inequality. What drives parents to invest their time and money into after-school education, and when does it make sense to do so? During my research, I spent time with more than 100 families who pursue supplemental education for their young children and talked with teachers, college admissions officers, and others. I found that parents whose children are doing fine in school still seek out after-school academics in order to make them competitive, often worried about entry to college. Parents see neighboring kids in such spaces and so worry that their kids won't be able to keep up. I also learned that tutoring works better under certain conditions, and in that respect, not all companies can provide those conditions. Instructors need to be able to connect the content to children's experiences to make the children more interested, for example. What's more, classes are most effective with smaller tutor-to-student ratios. Parents who use outside learning centers should ask how those businesses incentivize learning. Ask for references. If children prove resistant, stop. You want to instill lifelong learners, so their interest is essential. The education landscape is changing, and private companies are playing more of a role. We need to understand their popularity and their effects in order to create the learning environment we want for all children.
That was Pawan Dhingra of Amherst College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.